Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
That's a cool song. I love it. Done by Kevin MacLeod. So you can look this guy up. Great royalty-free music that he puts out there. Thank you, Mr. MacLeod. But you are listening to, my friend, UFO Think Tank Radio, and my name is Alejandro T. Rojas. Thank you for listening. And I'm so excited. I think I forgot to mention this last week, and I'm very much apologize to my great friends over there at UFO Paranormal Radio. So if you're listening on UFO Paranormal Radio, thanks for tuning in, and I am very excited to be a part of this awesome network ran by Joe Montaldo. They're now syndicating my show, so it's being heard around the world, and I am sure once we are able to work it out, Joe will be the first guy to be doing internet radio, INET webcasting, and other galaxies. That's going to be a great thing. Hopefully they'll be able to understand us, and you know, that would be weird because a lot of these stories, these guys communicate kind of brain to brain, so how will that work? How will... You know, that's just, when we talk about UFO disclosures, it's going to have such an impact on so many aspects of our lives, including web chat, you know, web radio, we better start thinking about that. Anyway, thank you all for being here with me today. And as usual, we start off with some UFO news. So let's check out what's been happening this week, and as usual, there has been a lot going on. In fact, we will start off with some of our stories. I think I wasn't able to cover this one with you guys last week, or maybe it was the last one I covered, but talking about, Dr. Jesse Marcel in Roswell. But a great story by Kevin Randall. Kevin Randall being a Roswell researcher, a UFO researcher, and going to be one of the gentlemen speaking at our MUFON symposium coming up here. You know what I ought to tell you about? Something special going on also, which is our guest tonight, who is James Carrion, the International Director of the Mutual UFO Network. And I'm very excited to have him on because he doesn't do a whole lot of media. Typically when the media gets a hold of him, he says, talk to Alejandro. That's me, because I handle most of those media spots. And so I end up doing those interviews and getting beat up for MUFON for him. Just kidding. Actually, I get to talk with a lot of wonderful people and share a lot of great information because MUFON does some good stuff. So we'll be able to talk to James Carrion today, and that's very exciting. We'll talk a lot about the symposium, and you guys can come out and see James talk. You know, we had... our guest last week, John Venture, who will also be talking at the symposium, and the gentleman I'm speaking of now, Kevin Randall, will also be at the symposium. But he wrote a great story about Jesse Marcel getting beat up, I guess, in some of the UFO arenas and people calling him a liar and stuff like that. And he's pretty much defending him and telling him, hey, this guy's an American hero, Jesse Marcel. And he's not even talking about the UFO subject. Jesse Marcel is actually a doctor. He's a flight surgeon for the Army. He's done a couple of tours in Iraq. So that's why this gentleman's an American hero, regardless of the fact that he is coming forward with what his father experienced and sharing, hey, you know, my father showed me this material that didn't seem to be anything that we had been able to create. My father told me that this was, you know, material from a crashed saucer that was probably from an extraterrestrial craft. And so, you know, he believed his father, and he has since not been able to explain what he saw. So that's great that he comes out and talks, and Kevin Randall's pretty much saying, you know, don't beat this guy up for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, for being there when his dad came and showed him this stuff. Also, Roger Marsh. We talk a lot about Roger Marsh because he's been doing some really cool stuff as the UFO examiner on examiner.com. Also, mostly posting some MUFON stories. But he has a story here on the Washington MUFON chief investigator who launched a new website, James Clarkson. So that's something that you got to check out because he's putting a lot of information out there of sightings in the area. You know, recently I talked about New England doing the same kind of thing, conglomeration of the different MUFON groups. So it's great that these guys are getting together and doing a lot. You know, MUFON groups here and there are doing a lot of great stuff, and maybe James will be able to update us on that in just a minute here. Also, a story on a dozen silent UFOs crossing the Ohio skies, another MUFON report. Remember, you can go to MUFON.com and look at these reports in real time. As soon as that person pushes submit, when they put in a report on the website, you're able to see that and read the details of that sighting. In fact, we even have a graphical interface that works with Google where you can see a little icon instantly pop up, and this thing self updates itself. So you can open this, have it open at work all day long, go check it out, and you'll be able to see the new sightings pop up and stay up to date. And, you know, that way if maybe you're at work and you see, you know, a dozen sightings surrounding the area where you work, you know that, you know, maybe it's time to kind of hit the road and go visit grandma in the next state or something. Or go take a look and start snapping some pictures or taking some video. And you can submit that to the CMS also. It's so advanced that they can take pictures and videos on there. And there's some great pictures and videos. And Roger Marsh often will post those as well. Right here in Lakewood, Colorado, which is the town next door, the town I actually work in, here in the metro area of Denver, that people had seen a UFO hovering over rooftops. So that was another sighting that was reported recently. You know, people talk about sightings here and there, and the news really plays it down, but they don't really mention or highlight the truth that there are hundreds of sightings a month, literally hundreds of sightings a month. James sends us out a monthly report that shows how many sightings there have been for the month. And there are literally hundreds that we receive a month and thousands over a year. And a lot of these people are very credible. Some of the very credible people out there, in fact, are the subject of my next story, which is some videos that have come out lately that are really interesting. You know, one of them is Buzz Aldrin talking about a monolith on the moon, one of the moons of Mars. And of course, a monolith could be just a structure, a rock structure or something like that. But it's interesting that the way he talks about it, and you can see this video, he's like, you know, if people knew about that, we got to go check out who built that and why that's there. This is a strange object. And so he's alluding to something more mysterious than just a, you know, a normal rock jutting out there. And you may have heard the stories of Buzz Aldrin in the past waffling on whether he's seen UFOs or not. Sometimes he says he does. Sometimes he tries to explain away what he saw. So really interesting what's going on with Buzz Aldrin, and definitely with this interview. He was really trying to hype people up and talk about how we need to go to the Mars, we need to establish bases on the Mars. Really, and a lot of scientists talk this way, Mars is the best place to go instead of a space station, which is much more difficult to maintain. You know, it's much more difficult to expand. If we went to the moon, that could be our launch platform to go to Mars. So that's really a lot of people talk about. That's really the next step if we want to do some real space exploration, turning the moon into our space station. So, you know, much easier. Another interesting video that I posted here is the Obama press secretary was doing an interview recently, early in the morning, and they took some calls from listeners, and one of the listeners asked the UFO question. You know, he did a great job saying, hey, I know this may sound silly, but please take this serious. You know, he mentioned Edgar Mitchell, another astronaut who had been on the moon, and Edgar Mitchell talking about how he knew Roswell was the real deal. And so this guy did treat him really nice. He said, you know, we haven't talked about that. I haven't talked about that with Obama, but we certainly are committed to transparency in government. So I don't know if that's going to move anything, but it was an interesting transaction that you can see there. And these videos, remember, all of this stuff I'm talking about, you can go to ufothinktank.com, scroll down, and you'll see this on the front page, these news stories. Or you can go to MUFON.com and go to the UFO Newswire, and you'll also see these stories. And finally, a lot of triangles being seen. Again, Roger Marsh writing a story on triangle UFOs being seen over four states. And just recently, he had written about triangular UFOs being seen over six states. So you may remember in Belgium in the 90s, and we actually had the general who had done the investigation on these triangles that they were seeing out there at our last symposium in San Jose, wonderful person. You can go to MUFON.com and purchase his talk, and I highly, highly recommend you do that because he covered how, you know, dozens of police officers, military, other witnesses had seen these triangles. They tracked where they had seen these triangles over Belgium. It was just a wonderful talk. I loved it. And so you got to go check that out. But more triangles being seen over the U.S. Very strange. But without further ado, I believe that we have Mr. James Carrion on the phone.
I'm here, Alejandro. Carrion. How are you?
Great. I can hear you just fine.
Super.
Sounded very good. So I had talked about earlier, I have a lot of stuff, actually, I want to talk about with you. But not to be cruel or anything, but, you know, some of the more difficult questions I face, and they're actually not difficult. They're kind of fun, and I like to clear the air on some things. But, you know, I was thinking it would be kind of neat to ask you some of those questions and see how you would respond to some of them. The first being, I get this a lot, and I'm sure you get it sometimes too, how MUFON is part of the government and MUFON is spreading disinformation or keeping information back from the public. What do you think about that?
It's absolutely true. No, I'm just kidding. Hopefully not. No, you know, it's funny because we are accused all the time of being part of some grand conspiracy. Actually, there's probably three or four MUFON board members that are on some top 100 men in black list that's floating around the internet. You know, the accusations are ridiculous. And if anybody were to come to the symposium this year and listen to my talk, specifically my talk, on some of the new research I've done from the very early days of UFOs and the government complicity and the start of a cover-up, and actually for some very different reasons that I'm going to be showing, I think they would be very, you know, very hesitant to make any accusations about MUFON any longer. I mean, we are very much open. You know, for us, the truth is it. And so, you know, we're trying to just be as honest as possible and as forthcoming as possible about our research, what we do, how we do it. And, you know, we're just on a mission here. We're on a mission to try to figure out what this mystery is all about. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not in bed with the government, or there's no complicity there.
Yeah, and it's, you know, being part and seeing how all this works, it's just funny. And I tell people the same thing, you know, come to a symposium or something, you'll see very quickly that's not the truth, that's just kind of conspiracy talk out there. And a lot of people, as you know, it's kind of like, if you don't see the things the way I do, then you're probably a disinformationist.
Right, and I would agree with that. And, you know, actually, I would have to say that they're, just based on the time I've spent to MUFON, I've seen enough of some of the investigations we've done into some of the allegations and some of the claims that have been made on the Internet and so on, to know that there is disinformation going on. There are active disinformation agents out there planting information in the UFO field, you know, selling strange and wild stories. But it's not originating from within MUFON. This is usually something that pops up on some website somewhere, or somebody's starts making some strange claims. But it's not from within the organization. So there is some truth to there being disinformation out there and then actively being seeded. But it's not from within MUFON itself.
Yeah, I had this guy just the other day call me and give me a whole earload and he just wouldn't stop, and I wish I would have known earlier how to make him stop, essentially just to disagree with him one time. Well, I didn't necessarily disagree with him. He just went in about Phil Schneider and underground bases, and I told him, well, not everybody believes in Phil Schneider, and he said, oh, my gosh, MUFON is part of the Illuminati, aren't they? Click.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah, some silly stuff. But you had talked about disinformation, and not only are you not, or nor ever have been, if I'm correct, a member of MJ-12, you yourself am kind of skeptical of whether MJ-12 exists or not. Is that true?
You know, if you look back at the history of ufology, MJ-12 is one of those, I actually call it a myth, because I don't believe it's really, there's a true group called MJ-12. And if you look back at the history, it came out right after Charles Berlitz and Bill Moore were releasing their book about the Roswell incident, and all of a sudden we get these documents that are talking about this group and how Eisenhower was being briefed, and the documents themselves have never been proven to be genuine. Subsequent to that, we get a whole deluge of MJ-12 related documentation, and all of questionable provenance. So the real question is, why was that documentation released at that time and for what reason? My feeling is that in itself was an active disinformation campaign. Send UFO researchers down this path to prove that MJ-12 was a real group, and in the meantime, the truth is somewhere else. So this is one of the many rabbit holes that ufologists have been sent down throughout the years, and I can name probably half a dozen where we've been led astray and kept really busy somewhere else other than where we really should be looking.
Yeah. So, and you do feel, I mean, even possibly more so than many others, that there is an active or possibly many active disinformation projects or programs going on to get information, poor information out to the community.
Right, and I would probably have to state, you know, publicly and honestly here, that my opinion is that there's a cover-up going on, but it's not for the same reason a lot of people think it's going on. I think the UFO field has been hijacked. It's been used throughout the years for psychological warfare, for counterintelligence, for cover for our own exotic aircraft. And that has been basically used for those purposes, but there is a true phenomena. The only problem is trying to figure out what that true phenomena is when the waters have been so muddied by these active agencies that have actively used it for their own purposes is pretty much next to impossible. So this is one of the things I've always believed, that us in ufology, we're never going to get to the truth. We will never know what the true nature of this phenomena is until we can unequivocally know what the role of government is first. And that's going to take a lot of digging and a lot of exposing how this field has been hijacked for these various purposes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts that way?
Actually, I do. I'm doing some very active research right now, and I don't want to divulge what it is at this minute. I mean, some of it's going to come out at the symposium, but I have there's a plan. There's a plan in place to start, you know, basically cracking this shell that's been around the field for so long that is the role of government, and I think there is a way to crack it. I'm actually getting together a group of researchers to work on that very same project.
Mm-hmm. I know it's something that John Schuessler is working on that I think is really exciting, is some of the cryptology and some of the work inside the government there, some of the government's well-known cryptologists in the past, and them working in the UFO arena and actually trying to come up with ways to possibly communicate with extraterrestrials. I can't wait till he finishes that.
Yeah, John shared some of his research with me. It's very fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Pretty incredible stuff. So, you know, kind of along those same lines, some of the bigger investigations that you've got, you've been a part of, I know you did a lot of work on those California drones.
You know, I looked into the California drones, not when it first happened, but soon after when some of the TV shows expressed interest in investigating them. The overwhelming factor that I saw that led me to believe that the drones were A, part of a hoax, or B, also part of a disinformation campaign, was the fact that there were so many alleged witnesses, yet we could never actually find one physical person that we could interview in person, you know, actually in person and claim to be a real individual. So 30-something alleged witnesses to these drones, yet not one real person. That just doesn't add up.
Yeah, and no, that's what started making me suspicious. In no case that I've ever seen do you run across, especially that many witnesses who don't want to talk. And then on top of that, the reports that they had put in were so ho-hum. They didn't show any excitement, when really in most reports, the person writing is just baffled and kind of rolling through, kind of like we do, rolling through the possibilities of what it could be. And they show some emotion, some excitement there in what they saw. And you really didn't get much of that in the witness reports on the California drones.
Exactly, or the single report that we got on the drones in the MUFON website turned out to be an email address that with no other contact information. So the witness just left an email address, and despite the fact that we emailed that address a number of times, we never got a response back. So again, we're dealing with folks that are anonymous witnesses, but anonymity is one thing, but you have to be able to prove that a person is real. So there's a whole issue of non-repudiation, and that was overwhelmingly the overwhelming factor there was that these people were non-existent. These witnesses were non-existent.
Yeah. And just for people's knowledge out there, a couple of things. Some hits. California drones, you can look at that in the past, and there were these real popular pictures that were pretty incredible that came out of these strange craft. Here again, these craft that were nothing like what has previously been described in the past. And these pictures, they seem too good to be true. And I think you've got some people to look at these pictures and give professional opinions on them, right?
Yeah, there were a number of photo analysts that looked at them. Our principal photo analyst, Mark Antonio, looked at them, and to him, they appear to be CGI, computer graphics and animation. And in fact, when he gave a workshop at our symposium last year, he even gave a demonstration of how they could have been done. And that in itself is not convincing. The problem with authenticating photos, it's very, very easy to hoax a photo these days with the state-of-art computer animation software and hardware that's out there. So it's very difficult to actually prove a photo is faked, has been faked. So we really need some very good analysts. And actually, we've been working with some forensic computer experts who have some very proprietary algorithms. We actually used their algorithms on a case in Mexico that we investigated as part of the show UFOs Over Earth, and we were able to show through forensic science how these particular photos, although we couldn't show that they were definitively fake with each other, they were definitely not the originals, as the witness had claimed to come right off his cell phone. So it, the computer world has allowed a lot of folks to create some very high quality hoaxed photos, but we're trying to keep up with them with forensic science.
I was impressed with myself at work when I took this wedding photo and then changed the faces of two people at work to make it look like they got married, and that looked pretty convincing.
That easy.
Yeah, exactly. So another case that you did a lot of work on, and you know, with the drones and with this other case, I think you did some of the best work on both of these cases. That's why I bring them up. But the Kinross case, and if you kind of could explain what that was and what you had found there.
Sure. Actually, the Kinross incident itself is an old case from the 50s where a UFO was observed flying from Canada into the United States. And so a jet fighter was dispatched to intercept it. And it was tracked on quite a few radar stations. And what they saw on radar was the were the two objects, the jet and the UFO, emerge on the screen, on the radar screen, and then the UFO moved off, and the F-89 jet was lost. They did a massive search, and they never found the jet. So fast forward, 40-something years later, or actually even 50-something years later, we have this alleged dive company who said, well, we were in Lake Superior and we were looking around looking for a shipwreck, and lo and behold, our side scan sonar picked up this object on the floor. We think it's the F-89 that was lost because we sent an ROV down, and we also see this UFO object near it. And so there were these sonar scan pictures that were released on the internet on their website. And the thing, and here's the problem, is when folks make claims like this, A lot of people, even leading UFO researchers, will not do proper background checks to make sure that these are valid claims. They'll just basically swallow it hook, line, and sinker. And so it made the rounds of the internet like wildfire. Everybody was really excited about it. So I spent a lot of time, hundreds of hours, trying to validate that the folks making these claims were even real people, that they had a real company, and none of it checked out. And eventually, when faced with all the evidence I had amassed, they basically shut themselves down. Their website disappeared, and we never heard from them again. Now, it's extremely interesting as to why this website even popped up to begin with, and these claims were made, because it didn't appear to have any obvious motivation in terms of, oh, we're going to make money off of the story, or we're going to be famous for the story, because we couldn't really figure out who these individuals were. So again, we're going back to possible disinformation purposes. Maybe this was some agency of the government out there that was trying to perpetuate the UFO myth for their own reasons.
That's what's interesting about both of these cases. With a lot of hoax cases, you know who's doing the hoaxing. It's typically the people who are sending out the information. But many times, you know who's putting out the information. They're posting it on their website, and they're maybe doing videos and sending emails, and you can talk to them and before their hoax is revealed. But in the California drone case and the Kinross case, still nobody knows who was behind those two things, and there seemed to be no gain for any individuals.
Exactly. There's no obvious money motivator for why they were making those claims.
Now, a lot of people had talked about, in both cases, and especially with the drones, kind of being a possibly a viral marketing campaign, and I never saw any evidence that that was actually the case.
Yeah, there were some rumors early on that maybe Alienware Computers, it was a campaign that they had launched, or that it was a viral marketing campaign for some computer video game or some new sci-fi movie coming out. But all of those claims pretty much fizzled. We could never track down any evidence that it was a viral marketing campaign.
A couple questions coming from the chat room, and hello to chatters, and thanks for joining. But one of them, I guess I'll ask the first one, Steve. The nature of the beings, I guess we'd have to go back. Do you believe then there are, I guess, the extraterrestrial hypothesis? Do you believe there are possibly extraterrestrials, you know, behind these seemingly intelligently controlled technological devices that people are seeing flying around?
Well, I think it's definitely a possibility. It's one of the many hypotheses for what is behind the UFO phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we also know that when entities are seen, for example, in abductions, that when the witnesses are taken on board what is allegedly a craft, they're told information that oftentimes doesn't hold to be true. So there's a whole threat of deception. So we don't really know. The bottom line is nobody really knows. We do know that folks see entities. We do know that they're observed on board craft, outside of craft. I mean, these have been witnessed for as long as the UFO phenomenon has been around. As far as their provenance, where they come from, we don't know that. We don't know whether they're extraterrestrials visiting us from another solar system, or they're time travelers, or they're interdimensional travelers. We simply do not know.
Yeah, and that pretty much answers the questions, because this person was asking, you know, essentially, if you believe they were angels or just beings from other worlds or other dimensions.
And anything's possible.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what I like to argue is, you know, where, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, where kind of the noisy negativists, as Stanton puts it, fail because they purport to be scientists and following the scientific method. But the scientific method doesn't mean, you know, oh, what you saw or what you claim to have seen is just so out there that it can't be true. Where the scientific method is more of holding up that possibility until you can prove otherwise.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of folks do not understand the difference between a skeptic and a debunker. Skeptic, I mean, basically MUFON considers itself to be a skeptical organization. We use a scientific method. One of the hallmarks of science is skepticism. I mean, it's very healthy to have a dose of skepticism when investigating any claims. But the difference between a skeptic and a debunker, a skeptic is willing to look at the data, to actually do their homework and investigate and research, whereas a debunker is somebody who just typically, because it doesn't fit within their paradigm, outright dismisses the research that has been done without doing any research themselves. So it's basically just a lot of armchair second-guessing, debunkers are just basically a group of lazy folks who will take somebody else's research and just throw it out the door just because it doesn't fit within their belief system.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the chat was asking you about the Jonathan Reed case and if you had any opinions or had looked into that much.
The Jonathan Reed case. I personally have not investigated Jonathan Reed's claims, but I have spoken with a few researchers, and from what I understand, Mr. Reed made quite a few claims that he could not prove.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And, you know, you had talked about the difference between debunkers and skeptics, and I know that because there have been, like you said, other researchers who have had strong feelings about the California drones and about the Kinross, you know, with the radar data. And in Mexico, you mentioned the Mexico case, and there were some researchers who had strong feelings about all of those being the real deal. But, of course, you had that for Jonathan Reed for a while, too. You know, what would you say to those people who are saying, oh, great, you know, whenever we hear from MUFON, they're telling us how, you know, our pet case is not real?
Well, I would say let's just compare the data. The problem with ufology is there's so much infighting, and there's so many investigators and researchers that are at odds with each other personally. It becomes a battle of personalities, and really that's ridiculous. What we're talking about is investigation, hardcore investigation, and hardcore data. So you know, my thought is, like, I'm not, or my belief is, I'm not going to go out and attack somebody or another UFO researcher personally. You know, I don't care, you know, what their background is, or you know, if they were a journalist in a past life, or an investigator, or a police detective, or a scientist, or you have a PhD. The bottom line is, show me the data, and show me the homework that you've done. And if you've done the same homework that I've done, then we can compare apples to apples. But to just outwardly dismiss my data because it's an issue of ego or personality, that's the problem. That's where ufology has floundered for the last 60 years. You know, we need to stick and just compare data.
Yeah. Yeah, and I find that, you know, even especially with other countries, researchers from other countries, lots of times their government and their media are very open to hearing what they have to say about UFOs and don't give them the amount of scrutiny that we get here in the United States. And, you know, that's why I try to tell people it's so important what MUFON does, that maybe your case even is real, but you don't have enough data to support that. Well, if you don't have data to support it, what are you? You're not going to be able to change any minds. If you get some real data to support and show that you've got something that is the real deal, then that's something that you really want to make the most noise about, because then you've got something hopefully that will open people's eyes to what's going on here.
Absolutely.
We have another caller, or a caller. Let's see if we can get them on the line real quick. So is there a caller on the line?
Yes, there is.
Hello there.
Yes, hello.
What's your name and where
John.
Are you from?
My name is John. I am the owner of the website called paranormal51.com.
Okay.
And the event that happened in my life that caused me to create the paranormal51.com project was an extraterrestrial biological entity sighting that I had when I was in West Texas, driving on the highway, driving east, and I heard on the – I had the passenger side window open because it was so hot inside, and I decided to stop the truck because I was hearing these chirping sounds, just like the extraterrestrials that were on the District 9 movie, these chirping, almost like a bullfrog chirping. And it appeared as if they were, like, teleporting themselves, following my truck, my Dodge Dakota, my silver Dodge Dakota that I was driving east to west in. And I heard these it sounded just as if it was, you know, bright as day. It's not like, you know, voices inside my mind or anything. But I stopped the truck, got out of the truck, looked in the direction where I was coming from, which was west. Then I turned around, and there in front of me I saw this arm that was less than 2 feet away from me. I looked down to the left, and I saw these circles on its arm as if it had some type of biomechanical suit. And so I was like, my heart was racing at the time, and I held out my arm, my right arm, as if I wanted to, you know, shake hands with it or something. I don't know, but I saw an arm there, and it looked like as if it had predator-like cloaking technology. It was it was as if, like, electrostatic shimmering outline
yeah, I remember you called in last week and told us about this a bit.
Yes, yes,
so,
but I wanted to get James Carrion's opinion on, or not opinion, but his experience as to if anyone had ever reported anything like the extraterrestrials that are shown on District 9 on the movie. I don't know if you've heard of it, sir, but it's eerily similar to, it sounded eerily similar to what I heard in the on the passenger side window out of my truck when I was in West Texas, and I wanted to get your opinion on that.
Well, I'm familiar with Peter Jackson making the movie District 9. I'm not actually familiar with the types of entities that he's portraying on there. I saw one of the trailers for the movie, but I don't think they actually showed one of the alien creatures, though they did show some sort of silhouette of it. So I can't comment on the similarity, other than, or on the similarity of the sound, other than maybe if your experience is real and you witnessed it, somebody else could have experienced the same thing, maybe even somebody closely associated with the movie. and maybe they drew on that experience for the creatures that were portrayed.
Yeah, the creatures in the movie are they almost look like a giant locust, or these giant bug-looking creatures that are, you know, about 6 feet or something like that.
I see. And the there are quite a few UFO incidents from the past where the entities were described as insect-like or praying mantis-like or something of an insectoid type being. So it's definitely not unheard of.
Yeah, stuff like that is reported, huh? So the MUFON symposium coming up here. To get more into that and what's going up on there, we had John Venture on, and I've had some of the speakers on before, but this is the 40th. So, what do you think is significant about that, the 40th anniversary of MUFON?
Well, it's definitely a milestone for UFO organizations or the history of UFO organizations. If we look back in history at some of the original organizations like NICAP or APRO, we are sort of the last surviving of these big three organizations. And I think that's due to the wisdom and foresight of the early founders, Walt Andrus and John Schussler, who knew that it was important to create a grassroots organization with decentralized leadership and basically empower people to go out there and to conduct investigations under MUFON's name, but giving them the freedom and the flexibility to do that without any sort of rigid hierarchy. So that in itself, the organizational structure has survived the test of time. But I also think it's significant that we're still here 60 years after the advent of UFOs, and we're still trying to figure out what this mystery is all about. That in itself is an important issue, and why it's important that MUFON is still here and is in existence, because we have an important mission that we have to undertake.
Why do you think MUFON is still around and the others didn't make it?
Well, I think with APRO, it may have been a cult of personality where a lot of the drive of the organization came from the Lorenzans, Jim and Coral Lorenzen, and when they died, the organization died with them. And with NICAP, there are plenty of rumors that NICAP was infiltrated by government agents to try to disrupt its operation and eventually went out of business. Of course, I don't know if those rumors are true or they've been substantiated, but we do know they didn't survive very long after they had a change in leadership. But MUFON's been around, and we're happy that we're still here, and we hope to continue in the future.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is really – because one of the statements I wanted to ask you about is MUFON being the largest organization of this type. I usually say in the United States, but you think in the world?
I would have to say we're the largest UFO investigative body. In the world. We may not be the largest UFO membership organization. I heard that there's a Chinese UFO organization that has 50,000 members. I don't know if that's true or not. But so we may not be the largest membership, but definitely the largest UFO investigative body in the world today.
Yeah, and I think, that's what makes that MUFON so great is we have so many people across the country and even in other countries that are actually hands-on investigating.
Absolutely, that's what we do best is to go out there and try to substantiate claims and interview witnesses, collect physical evidence, everything that has to do with field work and boots on the ground and really trying to get at the phenomena itself.
Yeah. Another question coming from the chat. They're asking about abduction, the abduction phenomenon, and how there aren't any speakers speaking about abduction at the symposium. So what are our plans to study that phenomena and help these experiencers?
Actually, MUFON, that's true. We don't have any speakers that are speaking on the abduction phenomena at the symposium, but MUFON does have an active abduction research group It's headed up by Lester Velez and a stellar team of scientists and doctors who are basically doing scientific research on UFO on abduction witnesses. In fact, they recently solicited a control group to work on one of the projects where they're basically doing surveys of abductees. So yeah, we do have active abduction research going on right this minute. In fact, the abduction group will be giving a presentation at the symposium to the MUFON board on the work they've done in the last year, and then hopefully that'll turn into a symposium talk for the next year's symposium.
Well, and for people, because I get that a lot too. That's one of the questions people ask. Well, MUFON doesn't care about abductees. Well, that's one of the things I point out is how one of our three Discovery Channel shows that you were essentially like the host of was on an abduction case.
Right. Yeah. No, MUFON definitely cares about abduction cases. And I don't think a lot of folks know even the research we've done in the past. One of the big MUFON projects on abductions was the Abduction Transcription Project, where we went out and we partnered up with a number of abduction researchers, especially those social workers and psychologists and sociologists who were doing hypnosis on their patients to try to uncover their abduction memories. And they gave the transcriptions of those recorded sessions to MUFON to transcribe and take out all the witness information, so we just had the raw experience. And so we did this for a number of abduction subjects so we could try to see if there were common threads to abduction stories. And there's we recently had that digitally scanned, all of that data, to give to our abduction team so they can go through it and try to figure out what those threads are.
Yeah, and maybe we can talk about, you know, that might be a good segue into the show real quick, the Discovery Channel show, which was a pretty cool thing that happened this year. And that particular case, I thought that episode, I loved all the episodes, but that episode was particularly interesting, and maybe you can kind of review that case real quick.
Well, we did three shows. One of the shows was a case down in North Carolina, where a gentleman was out fishing on the Cape Fear River with his friends, and they saw some lights that came down over the river, and he was off walking through the woods, and he experienced a ship that came over, a craft, and possible missing time. His son had observed some entities walking through the woods. When he met up with the other gentlemen down at the river, they all became very frightened. They got in their trucks and they sped home. And when he got home later that night, he encountered an entity in his backyard. So we went down there to try to investigate it for a number of reasons. Number one, it was a very compelling story because it had so many elements to it, but there were also quite a few witnesses. So we were able to interview each witness separately to try to see if they were able to back each other's stories up. And we did some other testing, some psychological testing, as well as a polygraph exam to try to put all that data together and come to some conclusion. And basically what we decided was something very traumatic did happen to these folks. We're not sure what it is that happened to them, a possible abduction scenario. And basically, you know, we were able to substantiate that that it was not a mental illness that was involved, but that definitely some very strange aspects to the story.
Yeah, the witness seemed very credible. Didn't he have some missing time?
Exactly. He claimed that when he walked up to the top of the hill when he first saw the craft, that when he walked back down to the river, that only 20 minutes or 30 minutes had expired, but his friends had stated that he was gone for 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. Another interesting aspect I thought of that case or that show was that a polygraph test was taken, and it wasn't positive. What did you think of that?
Well, what a lot of folks don't know when they watch the show is that it looks like that the polygraph was administered at the very end. In fact, the polygraph was the first thing that was done, and it was not only administered to the primary witness but also to his son, and they didn't show the son's results on the show. I think what we were able to determine from the polygraph, at least the polygraph operator thought that there were some questions that both of them were not being truthful on. And, you know, that I think what that did is raise some red flags for us. But we don't decide a case based on a polygraph. A polygraph is just a tool that will basically direct the investigation where to go next, and also just to raise some red flags that need to be addressed. So we don't necessarily put a whole lot of faith in the polygraph other than to use it as a direction tool.
Well, what I've found, and it seems difficult, is polygraph tests are very cut and dry yes or no questions. And with an abductee, and often people I've worked with who seem to have enough evidence or to show me some incredible stuff to make me think that they were really experiencing something, they often... just like many good witnesses, don't know what it is they experienced. And they're very readily, they're very open to telling you, I don't know what happened to me. Here's what I remember. Here's, you know, the results. Here may be the evidence of what might have happened to me. And often they're asking us, what do you think happened to me? So it seems difficult for these guys to be able to go on a polygraph and answer a yes or no to something they don't even know what happened.
Exactly, and it could also be the trauma of the event itself is one of the few results of the exam. So there's a lot more research needs to be done from competent scientists on whether or not a polygraph can be used in such a situation. But we don't place a lot of emphasis on it, despite what the show may have shown. I think there was artistic license on the part of the production company. MUFON did not place a lot of emphasis on the polygraph in this case.
Yeah, I think they did a good job actually representing your opinion and what you shared with us here is that you still, the polygraph didn't really have that big of an effect on your feeling towards this witness who seemed very credible, very down to earth, and had multiple witnesses of at least these lights in the sky.
Right.
So, and then the other case that you guys covered on the show, well, of course, you did Mexico, and we talked a bit about that. Well, let's talk some more about Mexico, because that was kind of rough. I mean, just to kind of clear the air, and from what I understand, what were your intentions when you guys went out there to investigate these Mexico cases?
Well, the intention was to give the show an international flavor, because the show was termed UFOs Over Earth, not just the United States. So we are trying to show that UFOs are a worldwide phenomenon, which they are, and Mexico has been reported to be a hotbed of activity. So we decided to just go south of the border to investigate. But one thing about doing a TV show, you can't call these craft in on demand. So it's not like ghost hunting where you can walk into an old house and it creaks and you know somebody bumps a table and all of a sudden you have a show. Things don't show up when you want them to. So we had to go and investigate the cases that were recent down there. The one case that was very compelling for me was the one in Mescala, where a whole town had witnessed a UFO earlier that year, or at least a light, a strange light that caused a direct electromagnetic effect on the town. And we know that because there's video that shows this light. When it grew in luminescence, the power in the town went down, so you could see the direct electromagnetic effect. So that was very compelling. And then, of course, there were these photos that were floated through Jaime Melson's office, very, very clear photos, and we wanted to investigate those as well. So we went down there, and at the time, those were the most current cases we could investigate, so that's what we jumped on.
And so... you felt that there was possibly some meat here. There's some interesting stuff that you might be able to discover something anomalous, hopefully.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's always the goal, is that, to try to find compelling evidence that something real and strange has happened. In the Scala,
mm-hmm.
we have the video, which showed something strange. But we also had a newspaper article that came out from a local newspaper that really, really embellished the story. Not only did people see lights, but they saw, you know, their cars were dying, their motorcycles were dying, their cameras didn't work when they were trying to take photos of this light, and creatures were seen. And when we got down there and we did our investigation, what we figured out was all of those elements, those sensational elements of the story, were not true. We couldn't find any witnesses to any of those events. But the whole town had indeed seen a light, and there was a direct electromagnetic effect. So once we stripped away the sensational parts of the story, we were left with maybe something that had to do with the power grid itself, and
mm-hmm.
that's what we were left. That was basically our conclusion, that there was a power event.
Yeah, I know, you know, when I heard that you guys were going out there, I was really excited because, of course, I correspond with Jaime and some of his associates occasionally, and it was a total bummer, of course, and I think you probably felt the same way, that, you know, these cases didn't pan out.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we know just from experience and the literature and all of the different cases in our files that things happen that we can't explain once thoroughly investigated. So we were hoping for such a case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're hoping that this case would be as good as any of the major cases that appear in the UFO history. It would become a classic, but unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Yeah. And fortunately, another bummer, of course, is that there were a lot of people coming out and saying MUFON was trying to make Latin Americans or Mexico and Mexican ufologists look bad or something like this.
Sure, which in itself is ridiculous. I'm of Hispanic heritage, so I have no desire to try to demean anybody of Hispanic lineage, and that was definitely not our intention going down there. Our intention going down there was simply to investigate and find out what the truth was, pure and simple.
Yeah. Which, you know, Ruben Uriarte and I were talking quite a bit before the show came out because he was kind of bracing me for the unfortunate, you know, situation that what had been discovered or that these cases didn't pan out. And he, of course, has a Hispanic background, you might not know it from my name, Alejandro Rojas, but I actually have Hispanic background too. But so we're definitely all, and you know, Ruben and I have certainly talked about ways to get, you know, more Mexican ufologists and Hispanics involved with MUFON. I know you worked on that with Ruben, so it was kind of, you know, I can see, especially with Ruben and I think with you too, a little hurtful, you know, a little bit of personal there when people make claims like that.
Well, I mean, I think to be in this field, you have to have a thick skin. So it didn't,
yeah.
And I got a pretty thick skin. But I think what it shows, again, goes back to what I alluded to earlier about the state of ufology and this infighting. And for some reason, some UFO researchers, when they can't attack your data, they'll attack you personally. Which
mm-hmm.
is unfortunate, because that doesn't need to happen. And I think that's what
yeah.
we were seeing.
Yeah, that is a total bunny, bummer. Someone in here, and this is maybe a good question to bring up too, and, you know, I don't know if you get this so much, but, you know, I know some of these questions, of course, are a little critical of MUFON, but of course, I get these questions a lot. And, of course, so in the chat here, I have a few questions coming across the chat like that. And I like to answer these questions because hopefully, you know, they understand that we're very open and that there aren't any secrets or big conspiracies they have to be afraid of when it comes to MUFON. But one of the people in the chat asked, where does the bulk of MUFON's money going?
The bulk of MUFON's money is actually going to printing our journal. I think folks think that we're this huge money-making operation when, in fact, we're not. We're a nonprofit organization, so most of our money goes back into services, either for our members or for the public itself in terms of education, in terms of our website. So we make a small profit as a nonprofit each year, and anybody can go and download our latest tax return and see exactly how we spend our money. That's all very much public record. We're not here to make a profit. We are a nonprofit organization. We're here because we have a mission to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think that's the big message, and that's what I tell people. You know, a lot of people think we have this humongous budget, but it's very tiny. And if anybody out there has ever had a small group where you print a journal or even a newsletter, it's expensive. It's very expensive. And $45 a year, does that even cover the expense for one person's journal?
It covers it, but barely. It's again, printing costs have gone up quite a bit, as well as just postage in general. So, a lot of folks say, "Well, why don't you just put out an electronic copy of your journal?" But we actually have a lot of members that would prefer a printed copy. So we're here for our membership. We're here for the public, and so we're going to stick to what we do best.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. That you mentioned a lot of people wanting the printed copy too, which I do. It's very nice to have a printed copy. You know, you can put that on your in your office or in your on your coffee table, and people can look at it. But I also found this interesting when I joined MUFON. I thought it would be 20 somethings like I was when I joined. You know, I thought it would be it was completely different than what I had thought. But when I walked in there, I found there to be a lot of baby boomers, a lot of retirees, and a lot of people who were professors and engineers and retired police officers. That, to me, was really shocking. Did you find that interesting when you joined MUFON?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, obviously, we have so many folks within the organization that are consultants or PhDs, well-known in their field, a number of research specialists, very well-known in their field, a number of professionals from all walks of life. So that definitely impressed me as well. Obviously, all these people aren't wasting their time here. There's something real to this phenomena. Otherwise, these folks wouldn't be involved. So that mm-hmm. really intrigued me as well, that this was the organization that I needed to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. And so when was it that you first became aware of MUFON, and then what led you to eventually joining?
I actually learned about MUFON when I was living in Florida in the late 90s. I had just gotten out of the military, actually early 90s. I just got out of the military and was living in Tallahassee, Florida, when that story broke about the six young soldiers who went AWOL from their base. And went to Gulf Breeze because they were searching for UFOs. And one of them actually went to was trying to attend the MUFON symposium in Pensacola that year. So that's the first I had heard of the word MUFON, or the organization. When I moved to Colorado in 96, that's when I decided to look them up and found a local chapter, and I joined.
Mm-hmm. And I guess even to back up a little further, what then got you involved with this field to begin with?
You know, Alejandro, I've been interested all my life. I can remember just back to when I was age 11. I have to thank my mom for this, because she subscribed to all the tabloid publications, the National Enquirer and the Star and the Globe, and it fascinated me, some of the stories that were in there, even though, nowadays people would look at the tabloids and go, none of this is true. But back in those days, especially the National Enquirer, they did real investigation of UFOs. Bob Pratt, one of the prominent UFO researchers, worked for the National Enquirer, and they would send him out on assignments and to verify facts and just like a true UFO investigator. So that intrigued me back then. I actually started clipping out old tabloid articles about aliens and craft and you name it, and had my own little news clipping collection going on. So it really started at a very early age.
Cool. And then, so at what point did you figure, I need to put my efforts and spend my time in this?
Actually, it was when I read the Condon Committee report. you know, folks who read the Common Committee report, University of Colorado put it out in 1969. If you were to read the summary where Edward Conan said that nothing has come of investigation of UFOs that would contribute anything anymore to scientific knowledge, you'd go away thinking, okay, well, this is a waste of my time and my life. But if you read the body of data, the number of cases in there that they investigated but could not explain, really good cases, radar data, radar visual, UFOs being chased by military jets, you walk away thinking, whoa, these folks ignored some real significant data, and there's something to this, and it begs to be investigated.
Yeah, I mean, when you read the Condon report, which people, you can get that online, it's actually a skeptic organization that has it posted in its entirety. But when you read that report, it seemed as though Condon, when he came up with that conclusion, didn't even read the entirety of the report. And some people argue that he didn't.
More than likely he didn't. Or if he did, he didn't really agree. Anyway, he was very prejudiced in his beliefs. And which he did disservice to science from that point of view, because he didn't take it from an unbiased perspective. He was basically, or his mind was already made up in terms of what his conclusions were going to be. But you know, we can blame Edward Condon for that. But at the same time, the report, the data is still there. So anybody with a critical mind can, if they read the entire report, will probably walk away with the same conclusion that I came to, which is there's something here. There's some significance here.
Yeah, I hope people read that report. And then I've read, Kehoe's books, and he does a great job following the history of what had happened during that period of time, because he was trying to assist with the Condon Committee and demonstrating and proving that, in fact, just exactly what you had said, that Condon had his mind made up before he even went into this thing.
Exactly.
This is kind of a funny post, I got to admit. We got a great people in the chat, but we have one guy that comes in here. He calls himself Pastor Pat, and every time he comes in, I can't help but mention him because he's such a funny guy. He's, talking about how silly UFOs are and stuff like that, and he talks about UFO witnesses drink rum, and they were on rum. So he asks us if MUFON would maybe come up with our own brand of rum.
No, I'm not sure. Really sure about that. I know Dan Aykroyd has his own brand of vodka, and he's a good supporter, a big supporter of MUFON. But I think we'll leave it at that.
Yeah. He had a great video out recently where you probably saw it. He's promoting his vodka, and someone asked him about UFOs, and he had a, kind of a lengthy answer about looking into it and how, they're real, and he's looking into it and all of this stuff.
Yeah, Dan's a great guy. We had had lunch with him in L.A. earlier this year, and he's just a real personable guy, so we're really happy that he's part of the organization.
Yeah, a lot of people ask, what is Dan Aykroyd's role in MUFON?
Dan is basically he's a big supporter of MUFON as an organization, and he supports our mission. He's basically our Hollywood consultant. So, if we want to talk to somebody that's a Hollywood star or a celebrity, we'll ask Dan to do the introductions for us. That's what he does for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great advisor. And have you seen his 2-hour or so, kind of just like a lengthy interview that David Cerita put out?
Is this the uncut video?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, I did watch it quite a while ago.
Yeah, I thought that was really impressive. It was Dan Aykroyd was certainly very well versed, more so than many of the people I meet in this field, and the history of everything going on.
Oh sure, absolutely. Yeah, when you talk to him in person, he can quote UFO history and major UFO cases and those major UFO researchers. He's very well versed in the field.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the chat, and interesting question. Has anybody reported a xenomorph, the type of creature that was seen in the movie Alien?
the movie Alien. Oh, the real nasty creatures. Well, I haven't heard anybody describe it in the same characteristics. But I think probably the closest would be the reptilian type entities that folks often report. But typically they're not bursting out of your chest or laying eggs. But yeah, so nothing that comes close to alien.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like that. Now, what are the entity types, the reports that you see most?
Well, actually, they vary. I mean, I think most folks think of the little alien grays when they think of aliens. But MUFON actually, well, I shouldn't say MUFON, one of MUFON's members, Ted Blocher, I believe is the way he pronounced his name, back in the very early days, produced a catalog of the different entities or humanoids that were seen, and you can actually see some of those types in our field investigator manual. But they come in all shapes and sizes. If you review this catalog of what entities are describing, everything from very human-like or creatures that look very human to those that are insectoid, to others that look like the Michelin Man. I mean, they just come in all shapes and sizes. So to me, it's interesting because I find the reports that, especially modern-day reports, those folks that report very atypical creatures, not the traditional grays that you see in the media or on TV, but the things that are varied or very different. To me, that actually lends more credibility because if somebody really wanted to make up a story, they would typically want to use what everybody expects aliens to look like or what they've seen in the media. So the atypical reports to me are very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And are there some of those cases that you think perhaps could be genuine?
Actually, the case in North Carolina we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. the way the principal witness described those creatures was very atypical. He described them as having some sort of exoskeleton skin on that was translucent, or exoskeleton suit that was translucent, and they had a face mask that I'd never seen described before. So, yeah, that was interesting in itself.
Yeah. Well, here's a good segue into, what I wanted to get back into. Someone asked, if you could give a teaser for the symposium, maybe some of, what your presentation is going to be about and some of the other presentations that we'll have that you're excited about.
Sure. Actually, I can tell them a little bit about my own research. I've been doing some extensive research into the very early days of UFOs from the time period of 1946 to 1947. And what I found is actually some very intriguing newspaper articles from 1947, 2 weeks prior to Kenneth Arnold. There was rumors that the United States had a top-secret weapon that outrivaled the atomic bomb. The press went wild with speculation. What could this weapon be? I mean, we thought the atomic bomb was it. And what could possibly be more powerful than that? And so as I started, drilling down or doing some more research into this very intriguing story, I started to see a pattern emerge that leads me to believe that there was no such weapon, but that that there were certain agencies in the government that were putting this story out there to try to make the Russians, the Soviets at the time, think that UFOs were American, that they were an American top-secret weapon. And I have some very good information I think will show that pattern. Now, the real question would be, well, why would they want to do that? Why would they want the Russians to think it was ours? Well, there's a number of reasons why that could be. It could be for counterintelligence reasons. We knew that we were very heavily infiltrated by Soviet espionage at the time. So one way to unmask spies is to put some very intriguing information out there and see who becomes interested in it. Another reason could be for deterrence. We were afraid that the Russians were on the warpath, and so we wanted them to think that we had something they didn't, even if they did have some stolen atomic knowledge. So there was a number of reasons why, that could have happened, but I'd like to prove it. I'd like to prove that that was what was going on. Now, that doesn't detract at all from the fact that, that maybe folks were seeing real UFOs flying around, but that maybe these agencies were using that to their for their own purposes, which goes back to my earlier assertions that the UFO field has been used and abused throughout the years by these various intelligence agencies for their own purposes, and I'd like to show that that was a pattern from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting, and I think it's cool. You know, I think that's a there's not a lot of people, researchers, especially no one, you know, particularly focused on uncovering disinformation programs, and it seems to be some fairly low-hanging fruit, you know, that you could at least prove that there have been these disinformation projects throughout history where they're trying to make the public or, like in this case, the Russians believe one thing or another, and that using the UFO phenomena as a tool for that.
Right, and it's very possible that the government, if we want to use that term, whoever these authority figures are or have been throughout the years, they themselves don't have a clue what the UFO phenomenon is about. They don't
mm-hmm.
understand it. They can't put their arms around it either. But that doesn't stop them from using it for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to think back to that episode of The X-Files where the couple is driving down the country road, and this triangle craft comes out of nowhere and abducts them. And these little gray aliens come out, take them out of their car, and then in the next scene, this very large, this much larger UFO comes down and abducts the gray aliens and the humans. And then later on in the show, they show the gray aliens being unmasked as Air Force guys in disguise. So you know, the real question is who's emulating who? There's a real phenomenon out there that is there. It's always been with us. It continues to be with us. But these agencies, with all of the resources they have and the money they can put into intelligence operations, are using it for their own purposes.
Yeah, I love that you brought up that episode because I bring that one up a lot also because it's one of my favorites. It's hilarious, but it goes over a lot of these themes too. They had some Men in Black guys, you know. They had Jesse Ventura was in it, I think, telling them, yeah, the president. Jimmy Carter did not see a UFO. He mistaken Venus for a UFO and all these funny, weird quirks.
Sure.
But that's a good one, too, that these guys masquerading to be gray aliens abducting people were abducted themselves.
Right.
Yeah, that's a real interesting episode. So I think that sounds very cool. I can't wait to see your entire talk, and worst case, if I'm busy during that time, I'll be able to buy it, which is always great about the symposiums, to watch it at my leisure. But what are some of the other talks going on that you'd like to mention or that you're excited to see?
Well, we have some great speakers at the symposium. I'm really excited to see what, for example, Kevin Randall talks about. He's talking about how science can be brought to bear on the UFO problem. It's been discussed many times before, but I think he has a pretty interesting approach to how to use a scientific method to go out there and do some serious research. So I'm looking forward to his talk. We also have Jeffrey Bennett, who's going to be talking about UFOs, but from a science perspective. In other words, you know, He wants to focus on the aspect of, yes, there are civilizations out there in the universe, so UFOs are a possibility. He doesn't claim that UFOs have arrived or extraterrestrials have arrived. He wants to focus on, I think, what we all believe, that yes, there's life out there. So I'm looking forward to his talk. We have Mark D'Antonio, who's going to be discussing not only how to handle the skeptical point of view or when you're talking to somebody who's a debunker. He's also going to be doing a number of workshops for us on photo video analysis. Frank Salisbury, Dr. Frank Salisbury, is a world-class plant physiologist, or I don't know if the correct term, but he's a professor of plant science And he actually is from the early days and wrote a book on UFOs over Utah. And he's going to talk about his research and what he believes as an academic, how, you know, UFOs can be researched and how mainstream science can be brought into to bear on that. Of course, you know, we have our favorite, Stan Friedman's going to be there. And let's see, John Ventry will be talking about UFOs over Pennsylvania and a number of, a lot of folks probably don't know, unless they've seen our show, UFOs over Earth, that Pennsylvania experienced a major flap of UFO activity last year. I mean, just off the charts in terms of what people are seeing. Even this year, that's continuing. So he's going to talk about his latest research. So quite a few good speakers.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Frank Salisbury, was he able to look into some of that Pennsylvania evidence? Because John had talked to us about, and it's also in the show, about those plants that were covered by that glittery stuff that was sucked back into this craft.
Yes, he actually did look at it. Actually, he was not asked to look at the evidence of the direct physical evidence. What was posited, he was asked to look at the research that another professor had done and to give us a second opinion. So it was mostly, you know, what is your second opinion about the earlier research?
Okay. So he was on the show then?
Yes, Dr. Frank Salisbury was on that show.
Okay, yeah, I remember that now. Okay, cool. So that'll be great. We'll have two different perspectives on that Pennsylvania case. It was really cool to have John on and have an update on it, because that was some really interesting stuff.
Yes, very interesting.
So, a question from the chat was that, has MUFON compared the sightings in Phoenix to Stephenville to Tinley Park, et cetera, to see if there's some sort of commonality between these mass sightings or these flaps?
I don't think we've done any research directly. I'm trying to do direct comparisons between those three events. I know John Schiessler is very heavily involved in doing research on triangles, which, you know, the Phoenix Lights, some folks saw they saw a massive triangle fly over, and the same thing with Tinley Park. So, yeah, there hasn't been any direct comparison of those three cases as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, reflecting on all those cases and other flaps around the world, to me, and except for this triangle one now, and well, except for the triangles, there are flaps of the triangles. Mexico seems to have flaps of the orb type things. But these other cases that he's talking about, they seem to be completely different phenomena, each one of those different cases.
Exactly. I think a lot of times, too, something like the Phoenix Lights hits the media or Stephenville hits the media, you get a lot of secondary witnesses that come forward and say, well, I saw something. It may not even be related to the first sighting. So you have to be able to separate, you know, the original raw data from the subsequent media-induced activity. So that becomes difficult in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of almost touches on something that you had mentioned earlier, which when it comes to the entities, a huge variety of different entities that are seen. And it's also seemingly the same with craft, that really if you look at the reports we receive with MUFON, it's, you have some popular type of shapes and sizes. However, there's a much bigger variety of these things than most people realize.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we look back even at our own case files, I mean, they come in all shapes and sizes. So it's, it's even, for example, that in that Pennsylvania flap, one of the primary witnesses saw a very strange hexagonal-shaped craft, which we don't get a lot of hexagonal-type craft reported to us. So, definitely all types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I know you're touching on a bit at the symposium, kind of the future of MUFON and research, and maybe is there something you could speak to on that in the last few minutes here?
Well, I think the in terms of future research, MUFON is going to stick to what it does best, and that's using the scientific method. But we want to take a more active role in terms of basically getting mainstream science involved with this subject. So we're looking to find a university that will sponsor a scientific symposium on UFOs. We want to do more of these research teams that we've done, that we're doing now. We have a history team that's looking at the early days. We have our abduction team that's looking at abduction data. But we want to keep that going with even more and varied research. So it's moving forward and going out there and gathering more data through databases that we acquire from other folks and other organizations and putting that in electronic form so we can easily search across it. So a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah, and I like to think that we are on the, hopefully on the cusp of seeing some scientific organization take this subject on, because for instance, at our symposium, we have one, two, three, four, five PhDs speaking, and that's not including Stanton Friedman. A lot of people call him Dr. Stanton Friedman, but he's actually, although he is a nuclear physicist, I don't believe he has his PhD, but he's obviously very capable, and he's done a lot of work in nuclear physics, so he's definitely, knows what he's talking about, but I mean, that's a lot of scientists right there.
Exactly, because that's what's really what our what we are. We have a symposium that's going on. It's a scientific symposium, so folks can hear the latest research. We're not just here to fraternize, even though that's an important part of it. We're here to present the latest data and the latest evidence, and we're looking forward to that.
All right, cool. So people can register for the MUFON symposium still. You go to MUFON.com. That's August 6th through the 10th. The investigator training is all day on the 6th, right? Oh, 6th to the 9th, excuse me.
6th to the 9th. And or folks can just show up at the Denver Tech Center Marriott down in the Denver Tech Center on the day of their choice, August 6th through the 9th. We'll be selling tickets at the door. They definitely don't want to miss our banquet on Friday night. We will have a few tickets we can sell at the banquet dinner. It's going to be a very important event, not only honoring folks within MUFON, but just talking about the history of MUFON and the proud history that we have. We're planning for a big celebration on Friday night. Of course, if folks are interested in becoming UFO investigators, they would want to come to our workshop that's being held August 6th all day, where we're going to take folks through a number of different subjects for how to go out and do active UFO investigation.
Perfect. Well, cool. Well, thanks for being on the show. A lot of, I think, great information. So I was excited to have you. And so this has been really cool. Definitely a lot of subjects to talk about. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. Take care.
And for you listeners, thanks for tuning in. Be sure to be here next week where we'll have someone involved with the symposium on. Got a few people in mind, but I've got to actually get their commitments, which I will do. But, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for coming into the chat. We'll talk to you next week. And also thanks to the UFO and Paranormal Network for having us online. All right. Talk to you all later. You guys have a wonderful summer week.